Committee on Judiciary back for order. We recessed here about 45 minutes ago. First thing on the agenda here is going to be the opening of a informational hearing on 3512. One announcement ahead of time. This is an emotional issue for many people. Be respectful of differences. I want to hear you booing or carrying on. Got some police officers here if that comes to that. I hope it doesn't. In this committee, oftentimes we have issues come up that there's a lot of difference of opinion on that are principles that people have. And we're able to work through it in a respectful manner. We expect everybody here today to do the same. Bruce Barker, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, just I want to thank everybody for being here today, and I know that people have worked hard in advance to be sure that people do have good decorum today. And as Representative Krieger said, that we do hear things in the building here that are controversial, and it's good to do that so we can hear each side of an issue, or at least the both sides of an issue, so we can help make sound decisions in the future. So I thank everybody for coming today. Thank you.
Okay, like we say, this is informational. There's no public testimony, but I'd like to have Dr. Russell Thorne, Professor Teresa Collette, Dan Eisenbacher, and Janine Eisenbacher up, please. In the seat, set yourselves anywhere you want to. Please identify yourself by name before you start to speak.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, other honored guests here today. My name is Teresa Collette, and I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In addition to that, I have served as Special Attorney General for the state of Kansas, and I'm currently serving as Special Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma in defending their law that requires an ultrasound to be performed prior to an abortion. I have experience both as an academic lawyer, writing law reviews on this particular topic, as well as a practicing lawyer, defending laws throughout the country. Today, the opinions I'm about to offer are those of mine alone. They do not represent the university, nor do they represent any attorney general's office or any other organization that I'm associated with. The issue before this committee today is whether or not to advance the pain-capable Unborn Child Act. I would argue that, in fact, House Bill 3512 is at least an open question concerning its constitutionality. Fetal pain is an issue that has been before the courts, particularly in the relationship with the federal partial birth abortion bill. I was counsel of record on the medical brief that Justice Thomas relied upon in Stenberg versus Carhart, and that was referenced by Justice Kennedy in the majority opinion and Gonzalez versus Carhart. At that time, in 2004, Judge Casey, who was hearing a challenge in New York, determined, as a matter of fact, that abortion procedures, quote, subject fetuses to severe pain. Judge Hamilton, sitting in California, determined that the question of whether fetuses feel pain is an unsettled question in the scientific community. The judge sitting in Nebraska determined to a virtual certainty that human fetuses lack the autonomy, the anatomy, and physiology to perceive pain prior to 20 weeks, but after that, there was evidence sufficient to establish that proposition. Today, the legislation before you asks to find, as a matter of fact, that in fact, there is sufficient physiological characteristics of the unborn child that it will experience pain at 20 weeks and beyond, and to prohibit abortions on that basis. For those who are not lawyers on this committee, a brief review of the constitutional law in this area may be helpful, and I will keep it brief. In 1973, the United States Supreme Court constitutionalized the question of abortion, an act that even Justice Ginsburg has expressed some regret for, because prior to that, it was a matter for the state legislatures. At that time, they established what was later characterized as a rigid trimester system, forbidding states to enact any legislation for the first trimester, allowing it only if it was grounded in a woman's health in the second trimester, and determining that viability was the point at which abortion could be generally prohibited as long as there were exceptions provided for the life and health of the woman. In a companion case of Doe versus Bolton, also in 1973, the court gave a broad, expansive definition of health. The health exception in the bill before you today is a narrower exception, but it comports with constitutional standards as established by the United States Supreme Court in its 1992 holding of Planned Parenthood versus Casey. At that point, the United States Supreme Court determined that a woman's health could be related to a substantial impairment of a physical bodily function. That is the definition incorporated in this bill. And the court specifically looked at that emergency exception and found it constitutional. In 1986, the court perhaps reached the high water mark of striking down state legislation. That was a Thornburg opinion. And in fact, it was repudiated in 1989 with Justice Kennedy writing, saying that we do not see why the state's interest in protecting potential human life should come into existence only at the point of viability, and that there should be some rigid line allowing state regulation after viability but prohibiting it before. It's important to notice that that was Justice Kennedy's opinion, because it was Justice Kennedy who wrote the stirring dissent in Stenberg versus Carhart, where he said, "The issue is not whether members of the judiciary can see a difference between the procedures of abortion. It is whether Nebraska can. The court's refusal to recognize Nebraska's right to declare a moral difference between the procedure is a dispiriting disclosure of illogic and illegitimacy of the court's approach to the entire case." In other words, Justice Kennedy has, from 1989 forward, clearly evidenced his willingness to sustain state regulations on the practice of abortion throughout pregnancy, as well as recognizing that there is a state interest beyond viability. His dissent was so persuasive in 2000 that a majority of the court, writing in 2007, reversed its position on partial birth abortion bans, and he then, writing for the majority, noticed that the government has a legitimate substantial interest in preserving and promoting fetal life. He also said that the court has given state and federal legislatures wide discretion to pass legislation in areas where there is medical and scientific uncertainty. Medical uncertainty does not foreclose the exercise of legislative power in the abortion context any more than it does in other contexts. This is particularly important because something within this bill that may be unique, although not sui generis, is the fact that there are findings of fact, that this legislative body is being asked to make a determination regarding the existence of fetal pain at 20 weeks and beyond. That determination, the court has recognized, falls within the legislative ambit, and it's a very important, in fact, I would say, it is a crucial part of the legislation before you. In order for this legislation to be sustained, the determination that fetal pain exists must represent a legislative fact. That legislative fact-finding process relies upon the fact that it is the legislature that has the competence to bring before it various members of various professions and determine when there is competing concerns in the medical community. This hearing today is a part of that process. I believe that this legislation is constitutional and can be defended. The reason I believe that is because it takes a majority of the medical literature and determines that fetal pain is a characteristic that the court would be willing to entertain to sustain a ban. But unlike the ban in the second partial birth abortion case, unlike the ban in the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act, this has a health exception. The court in 2007 sustained legislation banning an abortion process that had no health exception. This legislation addresses only those particular abortions occurring after 20 weeks of fertilization that are not necessary to sustain a woman's life or her health. That is what's distinctive, and that is why I believe, although open to debate, that this legislation will be sustained. It has passed in Nebraska, where I testified 18 months ago. And interestingly, notwithstanding Leroy Carhart having an active third trimester practice at that time, there has been no challenge to the Nebraska law. Also, I would advise this committee that this morning, the governor of Idaho signed similar law into effect for that state. Finally, I would also note for purposes of this committee hearing that the state of Oklahoma has passed similar legislation through both chambers, although there were technical adjustments made in the Senate, and therefore it has been referred to committee, but it is reasonably anticipated by leaders of both houses that it will pass and be put before the governor within the month. I am happy to answer any questions you have about the constitutionality of this bill. I am greatly appreciative of this chair, the chair's willingness to allow me to submit written testimony, and I stand for questions if the committee wishes it. Thank you.
Okay. Who wants to be next? Either one of you.
Representative Krager and other members of the committee, my name is Danny Eisenbacher, and this is my wife, Janine. We reside in Woodburn. We'd like to thank you for allowing us to share the story of our daughter with you today. The pregnancy that we're going to be talking about our daughter, began like any of the other four pregnancies we had had up to that point. However, at our 20-week ultrasound, that's when we received the news that our daughter had anencephaly. And for those who don't know, it's a neural tube defect that affects the brain formation. This was a shock to us. When we first got the diagnosis, we didn't really understand what it was. There was a flood of emotions and questions. It was very heartbreaking to learn that our daughter had a terminal condition. Yet she was our daughter, who we felt needed to be loved and cared for. We named her Angela because she was going to be our little angel in heaven.
We were scheduled for a more in-depth ultrasound a week later to confirm the results of the first ultrasound, and they were confirmed. We were approached by this new doctor about the options for parents who have a child like this. Before he could even say the word abortion, we said, "There is only one option. We are keeping this baby." He again approached the subject saying, "Yes, but we can go into my office and discuss your options further." But we were very insistent with him. This baby was going to live as long as God chose. By this time, we had sorted out our feelings and desires for our daughter. It was not her fault for what had happened, and we wanted the opportunity to hold her and shower our love upon her for however long we would have her with us. Of course, the weight of carrying this baby to term, with all that it would entail, knowing that she would not survive very long after birth, was very heavy. As a mother, pregnancies are not easy, and neither are births. But you get through it because you know at the end you're going to have a baby to hold, to bring home, and to raise. But with this pregnancy, that was not to happen. However, we could not imagine taking our daughter's life just because we didn't want to endure any future hardships. Our opportunity to hold her and be with her after birth was so much more important to us than freeing ourselves of this burden. It was not for us to decide when our daughter would die. God gave her to us this way for a reason, and that is the way we wanted her. According to the Oregon Vital Statistics report, an average of 250 unborn babies each year are aborted at 5 months and older. We didn't want our daughter to be one of those babies. In addition, most of the babies who have anencephaly are never allowed to be born, never given the blessing of being held by their parents, because they are killed after the diagnosis.
The anticipation of the birth grew as we approached the due date and then passed it. This is a common occurrence for babies with anencephaly. After we were overdue by 2 weeks, we scheduled with the doctor to be induced. This allowed us to schedule the date of her birth and let family and friends know so they could visit and meet our daughter at the hospital. When that day finally came, what joy there was when she was born alive. Apart from her condition, which affected, as I said, the formation of her brain, she was beautiful in every other way. That first day, we had a constant flow of people coming in to meet her. We were able to feed her, change her diaper, and hold her. We kept a hat on her head, which was partially open, and her brain was protruding out. She did not open her eyes and made only small, quiet sounds infrequently. Even with her condition, she did show remarkable strength. In fact, after 2 days at the hospital, we were able to bring her home with us and have her at home during the final day of her life. It was so wonderful to have her in our home with our other children and shown constant love. After 3 days of life, she died in her mother's arms, surrounded by her family. That was April 6, 2006, 5 years ago today, that she died. And her short life is still remembered by our family. We would have missed so much had we decided it wasn't important for her to be born. She has made such an impact on so many people and was a silent witness to life. She's still an important part of our lives, and we treasure those very few days we were privileged to have her. We urge you who have the power to pass House Bill 3512 to allow other parents to experience the joy of life given to them who might not otherwise have had this incredible experience. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Sure. I'm not Russell. I'm Richard Thorne, retired OBGYN. And another typo in the front, it's not F-O-C-O-G, it's F-A-C-O-G, which means I'm a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. My input today is to really to inform you about the problem of pain. We human beings have a definite problem with that. How do we know if anyone, human or non-human, feels pain? We know we ourselves feel pain. We know that from the direct experience of pain. But how do we know that anyone else feels pain? Because pain is subjective. We can't directly experience anybody else's pain. How do we determine particularly pain in someone who can't speak to us? Someone who is unborn, someone who is unconscious, or the laboratory animal. And today the question is for you to decide, should animal rights trump human rights in regards to pain? In 1966, 45 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed a law, the Animal Protection Act. It was brought about because of one man who showed undue cruelty to his animals way before the story of Michael Vick in dogfighting. And because of that one case, it went through Congress that we should treat animals with due respect, whether we kill them for food, whether we operate on them or experiment on them in the lab, they are due respect. If you ask any veterinarian, does an animal feel pain, they look at you with a blank stare saying, is there any doubt? And yet, the proponents of those who say the fetus does not feel pain before 24, 26, or 29 weeks, depending on whom you read, say that they have added a psychological and philosophical argumentation to what is pain. They say that for a fetus to feel pain, it must realize it is he or she is the one who is feeling pain. Even a newborn infant doesn't have that ability. And therefore, Peter Singer, who holds the esteemed chair of ethics at Princeton, an animal rights activist, says, because a newborn does not know that Bobby the or Jane, the newborn infant, feels pain, animal rights trump human rights. So we've had a law on the books protecting animals for 45 years, and today I would have you consider, isn't it about time that we do due process with our human mammals, we human beings? We have to start with a definition. I don't particularly think it's complete, but it's made by the International Association of Study for Pain, the ISAP. And they define pain as the unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or described in terms of such damage. A lot of legalistic terms, but basically two components, physical and emotional. Science of pain. If you read the literature, what is not in dispute? What is not in dispute is, are the receptors in the skin tissue of a 6 to 8 week old fetus starting around its mouth, and by the time it reaches 18 or 20 weeks, those receptors for pain are throughout its entire body. That is an established fact established by both sides. If you take a needle and you stick an 8-week-old unborn human being, it will withdraw its leg, just as your dog or cat or lab animal would, just as an adult would. When you burn your hand on a hot stove, the first thing you do is you drop the hot skillet and you say, blankety blank. You feel it right away. That is present already at 68 weeks of intrauterine life. The question is, is it perceived in the brain? We now know by scientific studies that all the 6 parts necessary to perceive pain are present between the 18th and 20th week of intrauterine life. I refer you to this picture number 1 in your handout. And basically it shows a foot where the receptor is being stimulated by pain or whatever. It goes to the spinal cord, which is number 2. It goes up to the thalamus, which is number 3, which is part of the structure in the midbrain. It then goes to the subcortical plate or the limbic system, and finally it goes to the cerebral cortex. We believe the science shows between 18 and 20 weeks all of those 6 factors are present to perceive pain. When fetal anesthesia is routinely administered at fetal surgery, stress hormones are decreased compared to fetuses who are not given that anesthetic. The elimination of stress response is crucial due to the impact of the unborn survival rates and long-term effects on development. The seminal article was in 1987 in the New England Journal of Medicine by Dr. Aman. And just 20 to 30 years ago, we thought that newborns didn't feel pain. I remember as a medical student and intern doing circumcisions on males and putting a 1-pound stainless steel Gomco clamp on its little phallus so it wouldn't bleed, and then doing a circumcision, and it would be screaming so loudly it would be red in the face. And even if you'd go into the nursery an hour or two later, it still had not, and it's been shown by studies, the stress hormones were still elevated. I was told at that time as a student or as an intern, don't worry about it, it's not feeling pain. Science was wrong then. And now they're given a local anesthetic which decreases the stress hormones related and the physiological responses to pain when the foreskin is surgically removed as a neonate. What is disputed? The Royal College of OBGYN used the argument of authority. What is and who is the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology? It sounds impressive. Like the group I belong to, the American College of OBGYN. Sounds impressive. We have 30,000 members. The Royal College has 10. Did those 40,000 people, were they asked? No. A committee of 12. A committee of 12 wrote an article a year ago in the Royal Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology stating that they now have added a psychological dimension to what is pain, meaning that you have to be the one to say, it is me that is having the pain. I must have a memory of that, and I must be conscious. Their main argument is that in order for a child unborn to feel pain, it must have a cerebral cortex, because without a cerebral cortex, you cannot be conscious. If you're not conscious, you cannot feel pain. A rebuttal is coming. 50 years ago, 2 neurosurgeons who were treating intractable epilepsy under local anesthesia would open up the brain and take out large pieces of the cerebral cortex, sometimes half a cortex. And what they found was that there was no change in pain perception, even with half the cortex gone. This led them to think that maybe the cortex isn't as important as we used to think it was. Kind of back to that circumcision argument that the fetus or the newborn doesn't feel pain. The seminal article And I'd like to have you focus on this picture because it's a picture's worth a thousand words, is by Bjorn Merker in 2007, a Swedish neuroscientist. And as you look at this picture of this little girl, you do not realize that she was born without either cerebral cortex. She has a diagnosis we call hydroencephaly. And yet, when her baby brother is placed in her arms, she has an affective change in her behavior by that of smiling. She can feel pain despite the fact that neither cortex is present in her brain, in her skull, just like an adult, a teenager, or a newborn. So Bjorn Merker has said that we have to reevaluate this whole idea that science says that you need the cerebral cortex to be conscious to feel pain. Data has shown that if you ablate, that's a medical word for destroying it with electrical current or laser current, or if you stimulate the cerebral cortex, that there is no change in pain perception. But when you do the same to the thalamus, that part of the brain we discussed earlier beneath the cerebral cortex, there is a change. So Bjorn Merker said this in conclusion to his article about this particular young lady. The tacit consensus of scientists concerning the cerebral cortex as the organ of consciousness would have been reached prematurely and may in fact be seriously in error. For further collaboration, the next picture shows an MRI scan of that lady, that little girl, and that black area shows an absence of her entire cerebral cortex on either side. What does this do with medical ethics? We know that pain is so important for survival that almost the entire brain is involved. PET scans data obtained during painful stimulation indicates that not only the cerebral cortex, but other areas of the brain, I'm not here to impress you, the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, etc., all are important in experiencing pain. There is no one center in control. That data, that thinking should go out that was present in the 80s and the 90s. Real-time ultrasonography, fetoscopy, fetal EEG, EKG studies show a remarkable responsiveness to the human unborn to pain, touch, and even sound. Our own child, we had remodeling done in our house in Staten, and we had a lot of drills going on and a lot of electrical equipment. And it was absolutely phenomenal that after he was born, whenever I would turn on a drill or electrical saw or handsaw or what have you, he would run out of the room crying. And so we know that it is there. Key point. When I was a medical student, the first sign of physical diagnosis is observation. We use our five senses to determine what the diagnosis may be. The veterinarian can't speak to the dog or the cat. He has to use his eyes, his ears, and his sensate senses to determine if that animal is in pain. When we see a newborn withdrawn from a simple heel stick and wrinkle up its face and cry or do a circumcision, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say they're in pain, whether it's a reflex or not. What we don't see with our eyes is a continuation of that stimulus up the spinal cord to the thalamus and to the subcortical area. So what does this have to do with midterm abortion? The abortion techniques are limited or written there on your handout. I'm just going to discuss what we're talking about today, and that is the method of dilatation and extraction of the so-called DNE. In the classic sense, the late-term abortion technique involves the removal of an unborn child from the uterus by total dismemberment. In order to get out through the cervix, which has an opening of the little finger, you have to remove a 5 to 6 month unborn human through that opening. The only way to do that is to remove it in pieces. It is the preferred method for second trimester abortions starting back in 1978. Most surgeons, quotes, find it difficult to perform after 20 weeks because of the toughness of fetal tissue at that stage of development. A quote by Dr. Martin Haskell, who has made a reputation for doing late abortions. Concluding remarks. 300 years ago, Descartes, part of the Enlightenment, said animals don't experience pain, they're not rational. He was wrong. In 1966, the Animal Welfare Act was signed into law, which regulates the treatment of animals in research, exhibition, transport, and dealers. 32 animal rights organizations exist. One of the greatest proponents for animal rights was Adolf Hitler and Himmler. Up to 30 years ago, medical doctors believed that newborns did not experience pain. So therefore, you could circumcise them without anesthesia. You could do surgery on them by not giving them any anesthesia but a muscle relaxant and oxygen. And they wondered why a lot of them died in the ICU after surgery. They were wrong. Up to 30 years ago, medical doctors didn't believe anesthesia was needed for newborn surgeries. Just 30 years ago. We operated on them by tying them down and giving them muscle relaxants so they wouldn't wiggle or move. In 1987, Dr. Aman's seminal article in the New England Journal put that to rest. In 1999, a British medical journal stated, given the anatomical evidence, it is possible that the fetus can feel pain from 20 weeks and is caused distress by medical interventions as early as the 16th or 18th week. In conclusion, you have to decide when you go to this last picture and you see a picture of a 4D ultrasound of a 5-month human being unborn. Is there a difference when we operate on this person, whether it's an abortion or not, versus a lab animal? It's for you to decide. And we have to decide, do human rights equal or trump animal rights? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Call Rory Thorpe, Michelle Stranger Hunter, Dr. Mark Nichols, and Jennifer Aldridge, please. And you go ahead in any order, but please identify yourself for our recording machine.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Roe Thorpe, and I am the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to present testimony in opposition to HB 3512. In Oregon, Planned Parenthood maintains 18 health centers across the state. Our biggest priority is to help men and women make responsible choices that prevent unintended pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections. More than 90% of our patients come to our health centers for family planning and other preventive health services. We also provide safe and legal abortion care. However, we do not provide abortions after the first trimester or the time frame contemplated in this bill. I'm here today asking the committee to oppose this legislation because it fails to adequately protect women's health and inappropriately interferes with the way in which doctors care for their patients. Let's be clear. This isn't a bill about fetal pain. HB 3512 is part of a nationwide political strategy used by those who oppose abortion even when a woman's health or life are at risk, regardless of whether or not the pregnancy is viable. HB 3512 is nearly identical to a series of bills introduced in 12 state legislatures across the country this session alone. Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Iowa, Indiana, Kentucky, Mississippi, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and now Oregon. Proponents of the bill have been flying the same witnesses across the country to testify in front of these state legislatures, pushing a political agenda that completely erases women and our health, well-being, and concerns from the picture. The Supreme Court has consistently held that women must be able to obtain abortions if their lives or health are at risk. This bill has a misleading and overly narrow medical emergency provision that fails to adequately protect a woman's health. In addition, according to Roe v. Wade, as well as numerous Supreme Court rulings, it has repeatedly been made clear that states cannot ban abortion prior to the third trimester. HB 3512 ignores this standard and the long-established constitutional framework of abortion rights. According to the Center for Health Statistics, fewer than 1.5% of abortions performed in Oregon occur between 21 and 24 weeks. 1.5%. While rare, a decision to terminate a pregnancy between these weeks is almost always the result of a tragic situation in which a woman gets medical information from her doctor about her health or the condition of the fetus that affects her ability to safely carry the pregnancy to term. These decisions are painful and extremely individual in nature. Women facing medically complex pregnancies, such as those with severe fetal indication, often have no knowledge of the complications of their pregnancies until 18 to 20 weeks into the pregnancy. Under HB 3512, women would be forced and to some extent coerced by the state to make rushed decisions whether to continue their pregnancies or not. HB 3512 provides a one-size-fits-all approach that fails to recognize that not every pregnancy ends the way a family hopes it will. A family with a wanted pregnancy that goes terribly wrong must make difficult decisions that none of us would want to face. This legislation threatens a woman's basic right to decide what is best for her and her family. Women with high-risk pregnancies need to have every medical option available to consider in consultation with medical professionals and their families to manage these difficult and sometimes tragic situations. These difficult circumstances are no place for unnecessary government interference. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon asks this committee to oppose HB 3512 because it jeopardizes the health and safety of pregnant women and interferes with doctor-patient relationships. HB 3512 does not and cannot take into account the complex realities of each individual pregnancy. The cruel irony of HB 3512 is that women who need help the most will be the least likely to get it. HB 3512 does nothing to reduce the need for or number of abortions in Oregon, but instead places women in peril. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Stranger Hunter. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I submit this testimony as the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon to express my strong opposition to House Bill 3512. NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon works to protect women's access to the full range of reproductive health options, including pregnancy prevention, supporting healthy pregnancies, prenatal care, and safe legal abortion. NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon and I personally have been involved in women's reproductive health care for close to 40 years. This past year stands out. We have repeatedly witnessed reproductive health in general and abortion specifically being pulled out of healthcare discussions and targeted for special legislative restrictions in Congress and in legislatures across the country. This proposed ban is part of a national strategy to significantly reduce women's access to healthcare that is the very best for her health. The reality is that while most women welcome pregnancy and can look forward to a safe childbirth, for some, pregnancy can be dangerous, and abortion restrictions that do not have adequate health exceptions endanger these women. Most often, it is women facing the dire circumstances who seek abortions that occur after 20 weeks. For example, a Nebraska resident, Danielle Deaver's water broke when she was only 22 weeks pregnant. Tests showed that there was not enough amniotic fluid around the fetus. Danielle had suffered an anhydramnix, a premature rupture of the membranes, before the fetus had achieved viability. Without sufficient amniotic fluid, the fetus would likely be born with a shortening of muscle tissue that results in the inability to move limbs. In addition, the fetus would likely suffer deformities to the face and head, and it was unlikely the lungs would develop beyond the 22-week point. The couple, in counsel with their doctor, explored every possible action they could to save the pregnancy. However, there was less than a 10% chance the baby would be able to eat on its own. They decided to terminate the pregnancy and asked their primary care physician if he could help them put an end to this nightmare. He said no, he could not. Danielle Deaver lived in Nebraska, where a law banning abortion after 20 weeks had been in effect for 2 months. Her doctor asked several attorneys to review the law to see whether he could fulfill the family's request, but he was advised not to, to avoid facing criminal charges. The Deavers had no recourse to avert the pain and suffering that was to follow. 8 days later, after Danielle endured intense pain, their daughter Elizabeth was born and survived for just 15 minutes. The overriding lesson to be drawn from the Deavers' tragedy is that ideologically driven abortion restrictions have no place in a compassionate society. Abortion is an important part of comprehensive reproductive health care. It is a medical procedure and part of basic health care for women. Reproductive health care decisions should be made by a woman and her doctor. The people who wrote the law cannot possibly know the circumstances of every woman and her doctor who are making medical decisions about her pregnancy. Women depend on their doctors to provide them with safe and effective medical care, and they should be able to trust that their doctors are using their best medical judgment to protect their patients' health. Under this bill, doctors would no longer be empowered to rely on their own medical judgment regarding reproductive health care, putting women at risk. This 20-week ban has human consequences and would deny care to women in tragic circumstances facing desperate situations. Every pregnancy is different, and we should not deny women abortions because we cannot know their circumstances surrounding their personal, private decisions. Vicki Stella, a diabetic, discovered months into her pregnancy that the fetus she was carrying suffered from severe major anomalies and had no chance of survival. Because of Vicki's diabetes, her doctor determined that induced labor and cesarean section were both riskier procedures for Vicki than an abortion. The procedure not only protected Vicki from immediate medical risk, but also ensured she would be able to have children in the future. Vicki Stella and her doctor were able to make the decision that was best for her individual health and her future. When legislators enter the doctor's office, a woman's individual health is no longer paramount. She can no longer trust that her health is her doctor's first priority. Women facing pregnancy-related difficulties should be able to make medical decisions with their physician based on what is best for themselves and their family. This law, as proposed, interferes in the doctor-patient relationship, the sanctity of which is a cornerstone of medical care in our country. This law proposes dangerous limitations that could threaten the health of women in the most desperate of circumstances. We respectfully urge you to stand up for the health of Oregon women and respect the judgment of trained medical professionals and oppose House Bill 3512. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mark Nichols. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. As lawmakers around the country continue to legislate issues of women's reproductive health, it's vital that the voices of physicians and other healthcare providers, along with the voices of women themselves, are heard. I've worked as an OBGYN doctor for 31 years and am a faculty member and professor in the Department of OBGYN at OHSU. I submit this testimony as a representative of the OMA and have strong opposition to House Bill 3512 or any legislation that requires a one-size-fits-all approach to determine the best medical treatment to meet the needs and best interests of the patient. Among HB 3512's numerous wording problems is language inconsistent with commonly accepted medical terminology. The medical community has traditionally established the gestational age of pregnancies based on the first day of the last menstrual period, or LMP. This practice dates back centuries, well before the timing of conception was known. This is the terminology that's used in the current reporting forms and records kept by the Oregon Department of Human Services. Adopting, quote, post-fertilization age, close quotes, terminology would be both confusing and out of step with standard medical terminology. In Oregon, Vital Statistics reports that 9,422 abortions were performed in the year of 2010.
Of these, the majority were performed at under 9 weeks gestational age, with almost all, 99.4%, within 22 weeks of the LNP. While rare, an abortion that takes place after 22 weeks of LNP can become necessary because of serious medical conditions that endangers the life or the health of the woman. HB 3512 purports to have a narrow exception to save a woman's life. As a medical provider, I know what this legislation includes as an exception is in fact so narrow that it cannot be categorized as one at all. Another concern I have is that in those cases of anencephalic fetuses that was discussed earlier, I've personally cared for patients with this condition. Some have chosen to continue the pregnancy, but only after they've been adequately informed. This bill would not prohibit carrying the pregnancy to term. What it would prohibit is women to choose an abortion in that setting. An abortion is safer for the woman. It reduces her risk of dying if she were to have an abortion at the time the diagnosis was made, rather than being forced to carry the pregnancy to term. The so-called, quote, medical emergency clause in HB 3512 doesn't include the health or the safety of the woman, even in a life-threatening situation. This bill requires women to risk their lives to carry a pregnancy to term that might or might not even be viable. Banning abortion at the end of the second trimester with an inadequate exception for medical emergencies could cause women to suffer substantial and irreversible impairment and harm. Carrying a pregnancy to term can sometimes cause serious threats to a woman's health, and healthcare providers must be trusted to use our sound medical judgment in those cases. Preeclampsia, a condition characterized by high blood pressure that develops in the second or third trimester, is a major cause of maternal mortality worldwide. In severe cases, pregnancy termination is recommended to protect the pregnant woman's health. Physicians may also recommend termination of pregnancy to protect the woman's health in advanced stages of cancer in the second trimester. Delaying therapy may subject the woman to delay in their care, risking further progression of the disease. I try to imagine the practical implications of 3512. I imagine trying to decide if a medical condition has worsened to the point to where I won't violate the law. Imagine the situation of a patient with a placenta previa, where the placenta is right against the cervix, and she begins to bleed. And let's say, for example, she's at 23 weeks in the pregnancy, and I'm there in the operating room, and I'm able and skilled and prepared to terminate the pregnancy and save her life and prevent her from bleeding to death. But with this law, I won't know how much blood is enough. How big does the puddle have to be? How far into shock does she have to go before I can make the decision to end the pregnancy and save her life? When terminating a pregnancy for worsening maternal health, I can easily envision a situation where the optimal management would be rapid termination of the pregnancy. This bill would force me to start with an induction of labor, where a surgical procedure would be far safer for the patient. When indicated, I may need to terminate the pregnancy quickly to avoid further deterioration of my patient's already compromised health. These patients are highly individual, and these decisions are often urgent. Shouldn't I decide which method to use in caring for my patients? As a doctor, my patient's health is my top priority. Doctors aim to provide the best possible medical care for our patients, and we know that patients must be fully informed of their options in order to make the healthcare decisions best for themselves and their families. Your constituents, our patients, hope the Oregon legislature shares their beliefs that healthcare providers, not legislators, know best when a specific medical procedure is required to protect their health. If you believe that doctors, not legislators, should have the final say in complex healthcare matters, then you cannot in good conscience support HB 3512, which would prevent appropriate medical intervention necessary to protect the woman's health. Intimate reproductive healthcare decisions should be made by the woman and her doctor. The doctor-patient relationship, long recognized to be crucial to the health of an individual, is one built on trust and medical judgment. Efforts by legislators to interfere in the relationship by prohibiting doctors from offering medical procedures they consider safest and best to preserve the patient's health, do a disservice to women and their families and their communities. Major medical organizations recognize the danger in allowing politics to dictate medicine. The AMA, for example, strongly condemns any interference by the government or third parties that causes a physician to compromise his or her medical judgment as to what information or treatment is in the best interest of the patient. The American College of OBGYN states that, quote, the intervention of legislative bodies into medical decision-making is inappropriate, ill-advised, and dangerous, close quotes. Lawmakers are experts on crafting the best laws for their constituents. Doctors are experts on providing health care and services to the patients that they care for. The medical community relies on its experience, scientific expertise, and sound judgment to determine which medical procedures are necessary to protect their patients' health. Preventing the intrusion of politics into science and medicine is paramount to the health of our communities. Lastly, this legislation will decrease the ability of physicians to provide quality care for all of our patients by immersing them into legal battles and creating a veil of fear in the field of medicine. Strong doctor-patient relationships free from government interference work. What doesn't work is prohibiting medical procedures necessary to protect a woman's health. It is our duty as physicians to provide safe, accessible, and comprehensive reproductive health care choices for all of our patients. This legislation is leading our state and our nation down the wrong path. As a physician, I respectfully request that you protect the autonomy, dignity, and health of the women of Oregon and oppose House Bill 3512. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Ms. Aldrich, please.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 3512. My name is Jennifer Aldrich, and I live in Portland with my husband, Alan Christian, and our daughter, Anne Marie. I've enjoyed a career in the not-for-profit sector and hope that I've made Oregon a little more livable in the 14 years I've been here. I recently completed a course of study in accounting, and I'm preparing to sit for the CPA exam. In the meantime, I'm doing volunteer work for an organization in Portland that assists individuals with the training and resources necessary to find employment. Alan and I met when we were in graduate school and have been married since 1991. We started trying to have a baby in 1994 when we were living in Washington, D.C., and I was working for the U.S. Department of Commerce. I was 36. Once we made the decision, I became pregnant quickly, and we were excited to be on our way. 8 weeks later, the pregnancy ended despite everything having progressed normally until then. As crushed and disappointed as we were at the time, we had no idea what was to follow. First came three more pregnancies, all planned, all of which ended in miscarriages. It was devastating to us, but because we very much wanted to become parents, we kept trying. In May 1996, I learned that I was pregnant for the fifth time. After four miscarriages, you learn a lot about what has to happen early on in a pregnancy for it to continue. So I was cautiously optimistic when an early sonogram showed a normal fetal pulse and a strong if tiny heartbeat. However, my first pregnancy had ended when the fetus died after an early sonogram showing the same progress. So despite the caution I was feeling from my past experiences, the encouragement I'd gotten from my doctors and the book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, allowed me to start to feel hopeful. Because of my age, 38 at the time, sonograms were a routine part of my pregnancies. When my husband and I went in for a sonogram on September 5th, we were relaxed and chatting with the imaging technician. 5 months was as far as we'd ever gotten in a pregnancy, and we were excited to find out that our baby was a girl and astonished at the details that we could see of her. As the sonogram progressed, the technician became very quiet and stopped pointing out fun things for us to see on the camera. He became very intent on focusing on the images in front of him. By this time, I'd been through enough to know that this was not good. My heart was sinking, and I believe I started crying before he even spoke to us. What he saw led him to recommend an amniocentesis. We spent an anxious week awaiting the results, and they were disastrous. The baby was diagnosed with trisomy 18, a condition in which an extra pair of the 18th chromosome resides in the cells. This is similar to Down syndrome in that it results from an extra chromosomal pair, but the similarity ends there. Trisomy 18, also known as Edwards syndrome, results in multiple defects to the body, brain, and internal organs. We were advised that the baby would almost certainly die. I now know that even if she did survive the gestational period, she would have such profound brain and organ deficits that she would not have lived anything resembling a normal life. We came to terms with the harsh truth that the baby would die, possibly after hours, days, or weeks of being unable to eat on her own and struggling to even breathe. And for this reason, my husband and I chose to end the pregnancy at 22 weeks. We couldn't bear the thought of watching this child come into the world only to die in a hospital, fighting for a life she could never have. Anyone who tells you that this is an easy decision has never been through this. It involves making a choice between two options that are both heartbreaking. The type of termination recommended was a prostaglandin termination, where drugs are administered that cause very strong contractions, strong enough to cause the baby to die without surgical intervention. It takes a long time and it's painful. One physician told me that she had seen a patient take 3 days to deliver. In my case, I was in the hospital for approximately a day. When the baby was born, we named her Alexandra. Although she was no longer alive, she was whole and beautiful, and I held her and wished desperately that I could take her home. The reason I chose to terminate rather than carry the baby to term was first and always compassion for her. To force her to suffer a lingering death after struggling to live through the pregnancy and birth seemed outright cruel. Of course, I also thought of myself, my family, and my friends, and how it would feel for all of us to go through this long and painful process, which should have been a time of joy. But it was always first about Alexandra. I truly believe I made the most compassionate and moral choice I could have made for everyone involved. It was after that experience that my husband and I moved back home to the Northwest to settle in Oregon. I became pregnant again and had yet another miscarriage. After that, I gave up trying. I was emotionally and physically exhausted, and I wasn't getting any younger. When I became pregnant again, it was unplanned, but very much wanted, and finally, beautifully successful. My daughter was born in February 2000 and is now 11 years old. The idea of forcing a woman in my situation and her doctor into a one-size-fits-all approach is almost unthinkable. And it is for that reason that I'm asking you to oppose House Bill 3512. Physicians should be allowed to alleviate pain and suffering when the medical capacity is there. And the decision to do so must be made in private with a doctor, not by government. The debate about right and wrong has little bearing here. It's impossible to know in advance what you would do in this kind of situation or how difficult and painful a decision like this really is until you are facing it yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Close the informational meeting on House Bill 3512. Meeting adjourned.